Blog Talk Radio.
Masonic Home Companion. I'll try and be your lucid host for the next 90 minutes. My name, of course, is Dale Graham. You could call me Graham. Everybody else seems to. I hope your week has been going well. Let me take care of Louie and James here. There we go. Ah, now we can talk a little bit. We have a wonderful show today. I hope that you find it entertaining. The response to last week's show was certainly a clear indication. I try to use the response to tailor the work to see what kind of imagine what kind of things might stimulate the appetite. And this is like being in a wine cellar in one of the finest vineyards in the world. There's just so much variety. I'm pleased that you've been able to find something in common with me and with some of these ideas. We're going to finish up a bit on the program last week. We just ran out of time going over the history of the Royal Arch Masonry, and as well, I want to speak with you just finish up a little bit, because we've just passed the celebrations of Robert Burns' birthday, and that's an annual event where everybody, I hope, feels their Scottish heritage on that day. Everybody in the world, all 7 point whatever, or everybody is certainly can claim to be Scottish on that day and feel the pride. Do you mind if I just talk to you about an observation? I'm glad that you agree. I've noticed that, you know, when I hear things about Robert Burns, they're presenting accolades. Sometimes it troubles me that it's a bit mawkish, you know, that we talk about him being a heavy drinker and a womanizer. And I think, if anything, it's probably better that I have you on the radio, because these are the types of things that run through my mind. And when everybody is sort of glad-handing and yucking it up, I really feel that I don't have a place. You know, this isn't the kind of Mason that I'm not the kind of Mason that I think I see in many lodges, so I sit quietly. But perhaps some of you in your quieter thoughts have had a similar observation. One of the things that I noticed about Robert Burns wasn't that he was a heavy drinker and that he liked the company of women, but that what he explained to you and I 200 years later is his vulnerability. And I would suggest most people would have a great difficulty exposing that much of themselves to the world. A man who is poetry, when we look at it, we talk about him being the first to use a dialect really championing the notion of the common man, that there was some pride, that there was some integrity, that the values that were in a strongly held in a classed society were not beyond the ken, if I can use that word, of the poorest person. That there was dignity in being a farmhand, being a laborer. So when people say that he was a womanizer, I don't tend to agree with that. I think what we know is that if you listen to the private thoughts of a man, could we say anyone is a womanizer? Well, I suppose. I just don't think it's right to mock somebody for being vulnerable and being able to show what you and I can't do. Who amongst us knows himself? Who amongst us knows himself enough to reveal that to the world around us? So when I listen to Robert Burns, I can hear my daughter saying, "Oh, Dad, you suck the fun out of everything." But I don't mean to. It's just sometimes things are, as I go through life, things make me stop and pause. He had a deeper understanding of human nature, and he was able to convey that into a poetry and song. Now, today, just to wrap this up, I'm not going to go over any of the things that you've heard about Robert Burns before. Everybody, of course, respectfully, has a right to their own opinion about this. I, on the other hand, have a right to respect those opinions or not. And so I'm reading from a book given to me. This is one of the few things that was passed down to me from my grandfather, a very worshipful brother, Cyril Snowden Toombs. The Graham grandfather, of course, died when I was a baby of cancer, probably from inhaling some of the early crop sprays. I've had great insight into these two men, Cyril and William, William Graham, through the program that some of you will see, Wartime Farms. boys on Prince Edward Island did their duty, of course, but you could see that there was tremendous pressure to hold the farmers on the land because, of course, without food, the entire nation starved. History had taught that armies and people cannot survive. If you can cut off their supply lines, you can win the battles, even though the other force is larger. Anyway, my family all signed up, but they were restrained to. So they did the duty. They did the security. They were trained, and I heard little snippets of this when I was a little boy. Walking with my grandfather through the farm, had a great time doing that, where he would chatter away and talk to me. And those private moments, of course, when you're just a little fella. And being handed the reins to a team of horses at maybe 8 years old, and learning how to mow hay. That was a pretty big feat for a small boy. Of course, the women in the house went wild when they heard about it, but I was quite capable and knew what I was doing. And I could bring the horses in and unharness them and leave the equipment where I was supposed to. Plowing was a little harder feat, and that required a tractor. So we tried to make sure that the women weren't around when the little boy was learning how to do that. So that's sort of, I can't help but reminisce on a day like today because I'm opening up one of the things that I treasure most about my grandfather, Cyril. I was left his book of Robert Burns poems. And there's a little ribbon in the book, a bookmarker. And I've never changed it. And I like to think this is one of his favorites. And it's odd, and this is what I think he taught me about his sense of women, because he's writing about a mother. And he's this is a poem, a song, and I'll just read the first verse to you, so it's, I don't want to belabor the point. It's called A Mother's Lament, and the words were composed to commemorate the much lamented and premature death of James Ferguson Esquire, Jr. of Craigdroch. maybe this has to do with a time when I remember one of my grandfather's sons, one of my uncles, the youngest, was tragically killed in an accident when he was out working in the oil fields in Alberta back in the 50s, I guess. Fate gave the word, the arrow sped and pierced my darling's heart. And with him all the joys are fled, life can to me impart. By cruel hands the sapling drops, in dust dishonored laid. So fell the pride of all my hopes, my age's future shade. And that's what Robert Burns thought about women to me. I should live so long and pay such attention and have a grasp of humanity as that person, that man, that fellow. So don't let me forget to talk to you about, as we close today, about the Sankey lecture. And next week's show, I'm going to have a special guest that's agreed to sit down with me, Ray Worshipful Brother David Cameron. So it should be great fun. I'm looking forward to that. I have a couple of questions to put to the fellow, and I think you'll find them kind of interesting. But we're going to pick up on the origin and development of Royal Arch Freemasonry. Hello here. Let me just flip through a few things and see what we can come up with. Oh, there we go. So we were reading from the Transactions of Quattoro Coronati Lodge. Remember that? This is from their volume 108 from 1995. So do go hit the old bookstores if you can. Use bookstores. You see these. These are just amazing. And I was, for a few dollars, you can pick up some wonderful treasures. So I won't go over the material previously. The last show covers that. And in spite of the... Here, we'll just dig into this. This is on the origin and development of Royal Arch Masonry. We got to up to, however, in the first decade of the 19th century, it became abundantly clear that the ancients would insist on the inclusion of their fourth degree in the ritual to be established. Now, we're really talking about... That process where, you know, the Royal Arch is far more held in a different regard because it has a different history in Britain than it does in Canada. And when I look at the Royal Arch, I think that this, in 100 years down the road, the Royal Arch is going to have a very different role in Freemasonry than it does today. There's a tremendous amount of energy being put into keeping alive the process of the Royal Arch. And across Ontario, there are some wonderful things happening. The ritual is so, it's like embroidery. It's just so refined, layer upon layer of information and symbolism. The ritual is more elaborate, I would say, than anything perhaps I've seen up to that point, and thoroughly enjoyable. Of course, the key to this is whether the people in the room with you are like-minded. You know, are they there because they're enthusiasts? And I think if you were in a room of enthusiastic Masons, well, you know, everything is possible. There we go. Just pumping up another. Today in history, we have the birthday of the Duke of Saxony in 1500. Now, of course, he never did send us a birthday card or Christmas card. And let me see here. In 1621, William Ellis, the English physician, was born. And in 1756, Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart of Austria was born. And so we had the famous weddings. I heard a nice quip for a fellow gave yesterday. about wasting people's time that Henry VIII said to each of his wives, honey, I won't be keeping you long. The famous deaths on this day, the death of Ali, the final Sunni Rashidun and first Sunni Shia Imam, and that was in 661, an important part of the Muslim history. Names of Flemish painters and William Temple, the statesman, died on this day. Let me see if I've got something about Masonic history on this day. I hope so. History and purpose of Freemasons on this day. What can I tell you? Well, there's some things that went on today, but I can't tell you because otherwise then I would feel that I'm violating my my own sense of what I want to do and what I want to talk about publicly. Let's get into what's gone on with those ancients and those moderns and all of that paradoxical material. And this was the discussions back and forth about sort of the pressure points of the ancients to bring the fourth ritual, fourth degree, the Royal Arch, into the discussion. Sit back in your favorite comfortable chair with your favorite beverage clasped tightly in your hand with a little glass of Kool-Aid. I know that you're drinking in 1 ounce quantities. Diehards among the moderns were convinced that they were being outmaneuvered in allowing the perpetuation of an innovation, whereas the committed Royal Arch Masons were happy with the situation and resolved to request the Duke of Sussex to accept the office of first grand principal, and he duly accepted, as we know. The wording of the grand chapter minute is somewhat quaint. At a special meeting, he is said to have been introduced, duly consecrated, and invested according to ancient form. Having reached this stage, the grand chapter, as in the case of the Charter of Compact, they adopted a low profile. At its final meeting on the 13th of November, 1813, just before the Union, it was resolved that as the Grand Lodge of England has communicated its determination to acknowledge the Royal Arch, this Grand Chapter does consider that a union of this order with the Grand Lodge highly proper and desirable. It was further resolved that the Duke of Sussex be invested with full and unlimited powers to negotiate and conclude a union on behalf of the Supreme Grand Chapter with the Grand Lodges under the Dukes of Sussex and Kent in such a way as might appear to the Duke of Sussex most conducive to the general interests of Masonry. In the event the Duke of Sussex took no action in respect to the Supreme Grand Chapter either at the Union in December 1813 or for several years thereafter. To quote Article 2 of the Regulations of the Union, it is declared and pronounced that pure ancient masonry consists of 3 degrees and no more, being those of the entered apprentice, the fellow craft, and the master mason, including the supreme order of the Holy Royal Arch. While this article henceforth applied to the English Constitution, it did not meet with the approval of many other constitutional bodies. And it is interesting to note that to this day, neither the Grand Lodges of Scotland nor Ireland recognize the Royal Arch as forming part of pure ancient masonry. The last meeting of the Grand and Royal Chapter of the Moderns was in March 1817, when they met with some Royal Arch Masons of the Ancients under proceedings similar to those at the formation of the United Grand Lodge, when they were constituted by the Duke of Sussex at the United Grand Chapter of England. This situation is ambiguous in that the Grand Chapter of the Ancients is always under the direct control of its Grand Lodge, which ceased to exist at the Union. Hence, strictly speaking, the Grand and Royal Chapter of the Moderns had no corresponding body with which to unite. The United Grand Chapter appointed new Grand Officers, laid down the rule that the Grand Master and Deputy Grand Master of the Craft should hold office in the Grand Chapter as Z and H, respectively, and set up a committee to prepare a code of rules and regulations. Now, I'm not being coy here about Z and H. It's those initials are being used here. And those in that you can do a bit of research yourself as good Masons and good members of the good companions of the chapter. With commendable speed, this committee presented its recommendations to the Grand Chapter in April 1817, and with only two amendments, these were adopted at the subsequent meeting in May. Yippee, that's fantastic. I'm going to, there, I just sent a notice out, I forgot, sent a notice out to the whole world that this is going on here. In these, it is possible to distinguish the influence of the transactions and printed rules and regulations of the Grand Chapter of the Moderns, as well as those parts of the Ahiman Raison and the proceedings of the Grand Lodge of the Ancients in respect to Royal Arch Administration. These regulations codified the proceedings of Grand Chapter, created a parity between certain craft and Royal Arch ranks, and established the laws for private chapters, which included the requirement that henceforth a chapter must be attached to a craft lodge and bear its number, but not necessarily its name. In 1821, the title of Supreme Grand Chapter was adopted, and the development of the organization and government of Holy Royal Arch, but not of its ritual, might fairly be said to have reached the stage of being comparable with that of the present day. Now, further, the development of Royal Arch ritual. And I will edit this accordingly. From the records, of course, all that I'm reading here is public records, so... From the records of the ancient Grand Lodge and the minutes of lodges under the Premier Grand Lodge, we have evidence of exaltations taking place in both bodies, but in the early stages, we have no evidence as to the nature of the ceremonies, nor the differences, if any, between them. The nature of the ceremonies, nor the differences, if any, between them. The 1766 Charter of Compact of the Moderns provides, from its illuminated margins and portions of its text, a description of the regalia which had been adopted, in most respects similar to that of the present day, but likewise tells us nothing of the ceremonies. As already mentioned, such documents as exist circa 1760 are in French, but the earliest manuscript in English which has come to light is 1780, the Sheffield manuscript. This and others is described by J.R. Clarke in his book, Some Early Royal Arch Rituals. And this was written up, if you have a copy of the 1993 version of the works and papers of the Ars Quattro Coronati, you can find that. In 1982, J.M. Hamill published a paper entitled English Royal Arch Manuscript, Rituals from circa 1780 to circa 1803. And this again is if you're an AQC collector. In a 1995 edition, which gave us an appendix of 26 English manuscripts, two of which are fragments, and one, an English translation of a Danish manuscript, the Dovre, D-O-V-R-E, excuse me, I don't speak Danish, a Dovre manuscript. In an addendum, a further 10 manuscript rituals are listed. 26, got it. So people were creative. I mean, what they're doing is hearing a theme and then putting the, let's presume here, brother, they were putting the great minds, or the great minds were picking up the task and making the ritual worthy of us. So we had the foundation, but when we've been sitting with the foundation for 100 years or 50 years, surely and sooner or later, some one of us will say, we need to ask questions about that. These parts are things that we need to completely preserve. But here we have a question. What does this mean? And how can we have that flow so that the ritual is teaching on as many levels as we think is necessary? From the summaries of the contents of these manuscripts and consideration of other factors, Hamel came to the conclusion that while some previous theories could not be supported, there were those which were now open to doubt. These findings gave increased weight to the opinion that the great majority of the manuscripts are traceable to the moderns, but even though those traceable to the ancients were only two in number, the Tuna manuscript, T-U-N-N-A-H, Tuna, and the Old Globe manuscript, there was no evidence to suggest that the ceremonies were different. It also seems apparent that in the early stages under both jurisdictions, there was a prerequisite qualification for exaltation of having been the master of a lodge, and that the subterfuge of the ceremony of passing the chair was practiced by both authorities. The qualification remained until the present password was introduced in the 1834 ritual revision. So when you're looking at the difference historically, when we're looking at it, it's telling us that this was a very select type of organization because the qualifiers were rather strident. Not everybody, I think this, what they're telling us is that going through the chairs wasn't a matter of moving furniture, that there was actual abilities and talents that were screened out by the process of various offices, and that to qualify, the standard was different than it is today. The standard to qualify for the master of a lodge was different, and that was in itself a way of streaming people to the holy royal arch. It makes me think that there was a value then. There was, you know, when you have a famous celebrity coming to your town, and she's being booked into a theater that only holds 300 people, those tickets are hot. Better that than booking somebody into, you know, the Rogers Center where the audience is a very robust 10,000, but the place, you know, would just eat up that many people. Better to have it stretching at the seams. So there was a cachet, a value, I guess, a reason. It was important. It was important. The idea, I think, that somehow today we have, for a lot of reasons, I think we can explore this. We've let this slip through our fingers, have we? I put this as a question to you. In almost all of the manuscripts evidence discovered to date, the three principles are described as Prince Zerubbabel, Prophet Haggai, and Priest Joshua. The descriptions contrast with Clark's statement that from the only minutes extant from 1784, those of one of the Sheffield lodges, there were elections to the following five offices: First King and High Priest, Second King, Third King, Scribe, and Treasurer. The Sheffield manuscripts, however, details the officers as Zerubbabel, Haggai, and Joshua. There are several differences in nomenclature for the conjoint ruling function of the three principals, who were formalized by the ancients as the presiding chiefs. The only other officers mentioned are the two scribes and three sojourners. In some of the earlier manuscripts, there is no mention of the ceremonies of opening and closing a chapter, but the Douvres manuscript gives descriptions of these which are similar to the later manuscripts, which detail these aspects. Since the Douvres chapter was chartered in 1784 by the Grand and Royal Chapter of the Moderns, it may be presumed that the manuscript has a corresponding date and that it represents the workings around 1784. My, my. In the early stages of development of the ritual, the exaltation itself appears to have been a relatively simple ceremony with a short lecture in three parts. It evolved through several transitions to one of greater complexity with the lecture in six titled sections as a dialogue between the first principal and the principal sojourner. This corresponds with the record of the Royal Arch Catechism, watermarked 1804. Hamel observes that with the exception of that portion of the mystical lecture after the explanation of the signs, most of what we receive today in the historical and symbolical lectures is present in the pre-1834 catechetical lectures once they had reached their six-section form. There has been considerable disagreement among Masonic historians regarding the extent of differences between the Royal Arch ceremonies of the ancients and the moderns. The need to harmonize these have often been quoted as the reason for the establishment of by Supreme Grand Chapter in 1834 of the committee charged with revision of the Royal Arch ritual. There is, however, another reason which may be considered as a more likely primary cause. There can be no doubt that the early Royal Arch workings were pronouncedly Christian, with overt and covert references difficult or impossible for a non-Christian to accept. It is apparent from the chronology that the development of the early rituals is accompanied by an extension of the Christian allusions. At the time of the Union, there was an influential pressure group led by the Duke of Sussex in favor of universalism. It may be inferred that this group was responsible for the charge concerning God and religion being changed from the requirement of a belief in God to that of a belief in the great architect of the universe. After the Union, the debate and the pressure continued. Article 2 of the Articles of Union had incorporated the Royal Arch as the conclusion of the Master Mason's degree, and it became impossible to continue with a system based on a universalist third degree and a Christian Royal Arch. Hence, the balance of probability seems to lie with the de-Christianization being the focus of the establishment work and recommendations of the 1834 Ritual Revision Committee. So, brethren, what this is saying is that a ritual is not dead, that it is a living, evolving process. Once upon a time, I listened to the laments and criticisms, sound criticisms of Masons, much senior than myself, about this constant change. And I thought it odd at the time, and now I find it one of the less flattering things that Masons can say. But to be generous, these are men that have not done their homework. They let their sense of history slide a bit. And not to point fingers, it's not easy to do history when you don't have the access to the materials. So let's be generous. We are of a fraternal order. There were other points, other work that took the attention of the generations that, just before us. Important tasks that had to be done. So it's not to minimize that or just suggest that somehow we're in a superior state of being today. Of course not. But it may account for some of the things, some of the attitudes that, let's say that said, it suggests to me that as history is exposed, more is known, attitudes will begin to be more well-qualified, decisions and thinking may in fact change. Which I would suggest to you in a question, isn't that the point of the revision of ritual? The ideas need to be accessible. What good are they if they're not? Not necessarily accessible to frivolous, giggling boys, but thoughtful and reasonable men. After all, So the ritual revision committee had its work cut out for it in the day. This originally consisted of 9 members, which was later increased to 27 under the chairmanship of Reverend G.A. Brown. We see that we are embracing here the idea of universalism, universality. Now, quite a step. This was quite an expression of enlightenment in the day. We probe ancient philosophies and the great thinkers. Suleiman, the sense of this is not colonialism. Colonialism isn't universality. It's that expression of a deeper understanding and a connection with all people. Now, here is the risk. We are charged, and I would say to you, I would ask you another question. We do not judge a man by his faith, and in fact, we encourage a good Mason to have a faith in a higher power, and we respect that. So we are looking for our brother in terms of what defines his character and his heart, not the cover of the book, the outward appearance, not the sound of his dialect or his accent to us. Remember, we have an accent to his ear, or the type of food that he enjoys, or his history. His history will be different. We only progress if we respect that. Trying to force another group of people with a completely different history than our own to do something that we think is in their best interest because it occurred in our culture is to be a colonialist. It's to ignore the fact that certain historical processes are necessary for certain particular outcomes. Sometimes political leaders seem to have their head in the sand about this phenomena. Anyway, let's get back to the idea, the importance of universalism. It wasn't a dismissal of Freemasonry as Christian. It's saying Freemasonry is more than that. My. Now, you and I on the program have talked a little bit about notions pre-Christian and the evolution of the history of Christianity. It didn't just pop up with ritual and holidays and events that were spontaneous. It was connected. These are men and women with connections to earlier times and earlier influences, and we can trace them. And it's, we'll get into it. If it's been too long since we've done that. The shows, maybe there's some of the early shows we did 3 years ago. Remind me to do some of that around Mithras. And interesting, really interesting connections. To show the roots, like where did all of this come from? So keep that in mind that we had the notion of universality, and that we ought to embrace today quite openly. So we were talking then about Reverend G.A. Brown. He was the chairman of the 27-member Ritual Revision Committee and chaplain to the Duke of Sussex. And according to the Freemasons' Quarterly Review of 1843, get some copies of that, Freemasons' Quarterly Review, on page 416, with whose friendship he was honored up to His Royal Highness's death. So he and the Duke got along famously. The committee was given very broad terms of reference, namely to take into consideration the ceremonies for the installation of principles, as well as the other ceremonies of the order. Fascinating. Masonic historians have frequently attached a great deal of importance to the recommendations of this committee and its impact on the further development of the Royal Arch ritual. In Grand Lodge, 1717 to 1967, On pages 145 to 146, P.R. James wrote, "The revision was drastic. Considerable alterations were made, new ceremonies of installation of the principles introduced. The scroll was changed and passwords adopted. A special chapter of promulgation was warranted on the 4th of February for 6 months. But many provincial chapters were unable to send delegates as well as to find the necessary qualified personnel. The essential, as with the Lodge of Reconciliation ritual, was a supply of printed copies, and this was not forthcoming. The result is that the Sussex ritual of the Holy Royal Arch degree remains unknown. And though there are versions published which claim to give it, their claims are unfounded. Uniformity of working is as non-existent in the supreme order as it is in the craft." That was a quote. "The lack of contemporary evidence as to what took place makes it difficult to adduce the nature of the changes, but if the object of the committee was the elimination of all Christian references from the ritual, it was not entirely successful. It might have been thought that the revision carried out the 1834 special committee was to be the final word, but putting the ritual into practice was to prove that this was not to be the case." So I wish I had known some of this history. I think it would have made my experience as a rebel much more powerful, and for me, much more expressive, I guess. One item which had not been altered was the private opening of the chapter. This was conducted solely by the principals and past principals, the other officers and companions remaining outside the closed chapter door. On various occasions throughout the 19th century, attempts were made to allow all companions to be present at the opening, particularly as there was nothing in the ceremony which could not be witnessed by companions below the rank of principal. But it was not until 1902 that the point was won. A telling argument was that on installation night, there was little point in ordinary companions attending. They were barred from the opening, admitted to hear the minutes, barred from the whole of the installation ceremonies, and then readmitted for the investiture of the officers and the closing. Similar moves were also made in the present century regarding the presence of companions at the installation ceremonies themselves. The close links between the craft and royal arch were drawn in as evidence. If brethren could be present at the presentation and obligation of the master elect, why should they not similarly be present for the presentation and obligation of the principals elect? Common sense finally prevailed in 1962 when chapters were given the option of varying the installation ceremonies so that all companions could take part in as much of the meeting as possible. By a similar reasoning, it was considered desirable to enable as many companions as possible to take part in the ceremony of exaltation. And in 1977, Supreme Grand Chapter agreed to the splitting of the principal's lectures into catechetical form, catechism. So you have to learn something. Whilst many companions consider that an innovation had been made, the fact of the matter is that the Supreme Grand Chapter was simply offering a reversion of the original Royal Arch system of instructing the candidate by means of catechetical lectures. The 1989 ritual revision did, however, make it clear that those participating in the delivery of the mystical lecture must be installed first principals. So this is an ongoing, this is the honor of the Royal Arch, the Holy Royal Arch, a discussion, a process that began at the time of the ancients and moderns and continued up to contemporary period. My, that's a fairly powerful link with history, I would say, if you understand. And it helps to explain why, to me, some of the processes around the Holy Royal Arch seem to be still developing, still developing, because so much is new and old. One of the strengths, this is about recent changes, one of the strengths of the Royal Arch has been its ability to change to meet the needs of companions at particular times when society itself has changed. Sometimes these changes have been almost imperceptible. At other times, they have been the result of debate. One thing that has been common to all of them is that they have been changes in detail and not in the basic principles on which the Royal Arch was founded. The ritual revisions of 1989 were the result of many years of consultation, research, and discussion, and were only agreed after a lengthy debate and a free vote in the Supreme Grand Chapter. Although the items removed from the ritual were held in great affection by many companions, their removal, like the many other ritual changes which have taken place over the last 200 years, have not affected the essential nature of the Royal Arch. It still remains today as it was characterized by Lawrence Dumont in 1756, the root, heart, and marrow of Freemasonry. And there you have it. There you have it. Now, we'll come back. I hope that you've found that interesting. Just a second. Just a little interlude. I'm going to talk. I have some material from Harry Carr on the relationship between craft and Royal Arch, and we'll get into that in the upcoming program. And I've also got a really interesting article that I'd like to share to you about from a Prestonian lecture of 1973 on a search of ritual uniformity. So, and I think it fits in with what we were just talking about. There are those that will, say, well, you know, the only good thing is something very old. Certainly, we saw the Protestant ethic grasping to try and, King James certainly did it, trying to put an older spin in order to create authenticity. And I think we've covered this notion in an earlier program, that the older something appears, the greater the authenticity. All right, so it's a more than a little derivative of the discussions around ancients and moderns. But let's pay attention, nevertheless, to the importance of the lesson. And the ancients and moderns didn't discover this. This is a process that's been known around the world in different cultures for thousands of years. So when the King James was written at a time when there was competition for the type of there's always competitions about the interpretations. And what we have today, we can to assume that this was something that was just one thread, one dimension, and one idea, really dismisses a tremendous amount of information. The formation of what we have today came from eons over periods of time, testing ideas and reframing ideas. And in order for us to truly understand, we need to be able to also grasp what was going on at the time of these changes. The thinking was different. Values were different. It was like me saying that my sense of saving would be different in 1939 than it is today. Well, I would certainly hope that it would be different and would reflect the differences. So we'll come back to that. The idea of the relationships of the between craft and Royal Arch, and That's an interesting complementarity. And we couldn't really do justice to this type of discussion without looking at the ancient and accepted Scottish Rite. That is a really interesting process of masonry, if I can put it that way. And what else we have to do today is to talk just a little bit about your, I hope you've all been, have your well-thumbed copy of philosophy sitting beside you. You know how those young whippersnappers keep coming up with those deep questions just to try and put you off and show how clever and smart they are. And as Spike Milligan said in his Goon Show of 1918, "You silly, twisted boy." I don't know if we can work that into the lexicon of Freemasonry, but it's certainly a thought that might go through your mind. You know, a good try. It really is a challenge, though, I think, in all seriousness, to achieve those balance points where you have senior members. I think I'm starting to go to look at what defines a successful, truly successful, wonderful lodge experience, and it is the concerted support and progressive support of the senior members of the lodge, senior Grand Lodge officers and past masters. Now, when we walk into a lodge, I think this is a way that we don't have to search. I think these are self-evident types of expressions of success. Look around the room, and without saying a word, you'll get a strong and very powerful message about the character of that lodge. Is it progressive? Is it looking at the horizon, or is it are heads tucked down looking at the dust on their boots? The successful lodges, I think, are looking at the horizon because it's a balance point between whether there's new, you know, it's not so much, I think, the size. I think myself, a lot of lodges are far too large. I think smaller groups, but of course, you know, smaller groups have different types of communication patterns. But that's just a personal preference. But it puts more pressure on a small group of lodge members to be attending, and it expresses a different type of accountability. If you're only one of seven, then you not being there is important. And how many times do you attend a meeting where the quorum isn't met, although the overall membership is well over 100? This is an observation. It's not a judgment. And these are the types of things that I think qualify and distinguish effective and progressive lodges. The lodges do always evolve. That balance point between the most senior members and the enthusiasm of the newest members of the lodge is something that needs to be mentored into place. We can't expect our new fellows to come in and assume education. And unless we can't also, I think, present any one person as an authority on this. Because unless, you know, where do we start and where's the edge of that start and stop? The most knowledgeable Masons that I've ever met can tell me what they have shared, what has been shared with them, but always leave me with a knock at the door of the library so that I can go and explore and search in areas that interest me. I love when I meet you and I know that you've been pursuing a different area of study and you're looking at the craft much differently than me. It's an absolutely rewarding experience. It begins to show it's like that polished diamond with so many facets that to say this one facet is the deal breaker, I think is ridiculous. This is a beautiful gem. Your particular level of enthusiasm takes you in a whole different path, whether the fellow in Toronto, John, that is just this wonderful esoteric. He is it's just incredible to listen to him. And he's so enthusiastic about his work, whether it's the Kabbal or he's talking about the tarot or ancient philosophies. It is fascinating listening to him. And then talking to some fellows up in the Ottawa Valley who are excited about the emergence of masonry in their area and the connection of community to community. Now that, and particularly if you go down around the Kingston area, it's just such an enriched environment. And to say, are they distinct and different? Well, I would say, hopefully as a compliment, absolutely have a unique facet to contribute to my understanding of Freemasonry. And I find the appetite and the awe is there and present in all of the lodges. When we sit in a lodge, whether it's over in Tillsonburg or Windsor or Amherstburg or Port Stanley or Collingwood or Hanover or Durham or, you know, pick one, there is a sense of awe when something resonates, when a piece of work is delivered and there is that musical harmony, that vibe. And you just look around the room and the room is spellbound. You can see that on the face of men who have been Masons for 35, 45, 55 years. There is still, it takes a lot to open the window of that. I'm sorry, but after you've gone through 1,000 or 1,500 initiations, there's certain things that will inspire you differently than the first time you sat there and after you were initiated, slack-jawed and said, whoa, is that what I went through, where your emotion is still bubbling under the surface and you're being prompted by all of these revelations that you actually see for the first time with the next candidate behind you. That sense of awe is still there. And it shouldn't be, I agree, it shouldn't be sold short. It's not something that's given away lightly. It has value. It's not to impress, it's to inspire. And so these are men that are showing up. They're sitting there for a reason. And they're looking, like you and I, for that next answer, that next expression, that idea that somebody else can put to words something that they have felt inside themselves. Just like Robert Burns. The ideas that he could put on paper and that we could read and share that express a deepness of the soul, a deeper expression of the human condition. So that's the excitement of being able to sit with you and talk with you and find out. I know it gets tedious, yes, if somebody is profoundly declaring that their way is the only way. But, you know, I just presume that they're naive and that eventually the penny will drop. It is tedious to hear that, of course, because we share opinions, each valid. But I'm too much of a neo something or other. I'll have to ask the history philosophy professors to help me peg what I am philosophically. Maybe I'm stuck, but I think that there are certain unassailable truths that we need to be able to preserve. And in the meantime, we distinguish the difference between truths and opinions. And we have at it when it's opinions. Debate, argue, be ruckus, have a great time. It's sport, it's fun. The wiser amongst us, the wisdom inside of us, the thoughtfulness comes out when we can encourage not somebody to listen to our own language, our own rhetoric, but to be able to encourage them to speak to us. We become enriched when we walk away with a sense of the other man's thoughts and minds, his values, and we get a sense of what he's done. Whether it's do we overlook the gregarious? We find the gregarious fellow needs to step out in order to quell his anxiety. He needs to be able to chatter away in front of a room and gain all of that that sense of acceptance. Well, I'm more inclined to think, as you know, that we're contemplative. It's the fellow sitting in the back row, listening. After all, it is one of our elements of our motto, Aude, Vite, Tace. Which do you take as your mantra? Maybe this week I can leave you with a little bit of that. Pick one. Aude, Vite, Tace. it's the last. I spend a lot of my week listening, concentrating on what people are saying and what they're trying to say and what it means. It becomes easy to do it all over the place for different reasons. I do it because I've been asked to help sort out complex lives. Well, I don't know where the barrier to that stops. All lives seem to be complex. So when you're talking with somebody, you're talking particularly with a brother, we want to encourage the fellows to tell us his opinions. And hopefully we will find those points where we don't necessarily agree. But we can talk about a common subject. But it would be really boring if we're all singing from the same song sheet. And this brings me to a point. It doesn't really fit a rant today. But stuff I notice and stuff you notice too. The amount of criticism aimed at the ideas around our Grand Lodge. Judgments, let me put it that way. Better word, perhaps. But I've been stopped. I've stopped my footsteps to think that I have made a considerable number of obligations and oaths. I've taken them. And before I can... And I exist as a Freemason because of the authority of the Grand Lodge. I owe everything Masonic. My heart and my character is mine, but my status as a Freemason is through the generosity and openness of and opportunity provided by the Grand Lodge. And I think in Ontario we are absolutely blessed with. If you start to read about the differences in between Grand Lodges, I think we have a wonderful, wonderful setup here in Ontario. But I think at any given time, Grand Lodge, and you can ask me how I am doing. Have I fulfilled my obligations to the Grand Lodge? It would cheapen the experience for me, for my life, to say, yeah, I've done enough to get by. That cheapens the quality of my life. As if I'm only doing this just to get by. I can't think of anything that would feel demeaning to me if that was the point of my life, just to skate by with doing the minimum. So to answer, if you want to know, do I feel that I've fulfilled my obligations to my Grand Lodge? No. I work really hard, but I don't do it to compete with you or anybody else. I have to compete. I feel like it's like a golf game. It's like I compete with myself. I have to control my emotion. I have to focus on my goal. Thank you to Scotland. I have to focus on my goal. It's not focusing on defeating the other fellows playing with me. It's refining my own skill and ability to be able to hit that 20-footer. To be able to control the drive, to draw it or push it as I need. Have I done as much as I could? No. There's more. In the meantime, though, I find it very, very easy to not judge. Maybe that's one of the, I think, one of the deeper principles. And I'm not sure whether that came through the Royal Arch experience or the Scottish Rite. Incredible, incredibly powerful expressions of Freemasonry, or the craft, or all three. Different facets of the same gem. But there is always more that can be done and should be done. Diamond in the rough. Now, if I sit in a lodge where there is a fellow that has qualities that I admire, it's the fellow over in Elmvale that just has such a kindness about his advice. When he sits down with me, it's like he cares about what I'm trying to do. He encourages all the time. And you can see that when somebody is initiated in that lodge in Coronation. It's just a spellbinding experience. A couple of years down the road, you see these fellows carrying this sense of value, of camaraderie, of fraternity. And when I look around the room, the old boys are there encouraging them. And with all kinds of energy. And I have to say, I'm not going to blow the horn of my lodge, although I'd love to do an incredible job. There's a few in that room that they're inscrutable, just like there are in your lodges. But, you know, let me get into something a little more serious here today than what we've been into so far, as if that's the light part of the show today. I'm going to talk to you. I want to brush you up here today on a little bit of the philosophy of religion, if you don't mind. And then we'll kick you out the door we'll put on another pot of tea or open another flask of whatever you're having there, and we'll finish up the program and offer you just a little bit more of our hospitality here today. And let me see. This will be for this year. You're just going to have to do with this last little piece of Robert Burns' music. That's it for this year. We'll come back at that another year. Nothing like Robbie Burns set us up for a spellbinding sense of ourselves. So here's what you remember, Dimitri and Tasso. Dimitri says, "I was talking to Zeus the other day, and he thinks you're a bad influence on me." And Tasso says, "Huh, that's interesting, because I think he's a bad influence on you." So Dimitri says, "In what way?" Tasso says, "He makes you think that the voices in your head are real." Ugh. An agnostic is a person who thinks that God's existence cannot be proven on the basis of current evidence, but who doesn't deny the possibility that God exists. The agnostic is one step short of an atheist who considers the case against the existence of God closed. If both of them came across a burning bush saying, "I am that I am," the agnostic would start looking for the hidden tape recorder, but the atheist would just shrug and reach for his marshmallows. So these two Irish drinking buddies are in the pub when they see a bald guy drinking alone at the end of the bar. And Pat says, "I say, ain't that Winnie Churchill down there?" And Sean says, "Nah, couldn't be Winnie. Wouldn't be in a place like this." And Pat says, "I'm not kidding. Take a look. I swear that's Winnie Churchill. I'll bet you 10 quid I'm right." Sean says, "You're on." So Pat goes down to the end of the bar and says to the bald guy, "You're Winnie Churchill, ain't you?" And the bald guy screams, "Get out of my face, you idiot." Pat comes back to Sean and says, "Guess we'll never know now, will we?" Now that's thinking like an agnostic. Atheists are another story. Philosophers agreed long ago that it is fruitless for believers and atheists to argue with each other. This is because they interpret everything differently. In order to argue, there must be some common ground so that one of the participants can say, "Aha, if you concede X, then you must also concede Y." Atheists and believers never find an X that they can agree upon. The argument can never begin because they each see everything from their own point of view. That's a little abstract, but this story brings it down to earth. In fact, right into the neighborhood. A little old Christian lady comes out onto her front porch every morning and shouts, "Praise the Lord." And every morning, the atheist next door yells back, "There is no God." And this goes on for weeks. "Praise the Lord," yells the lady. "There is no God," responds the neighbor. As time goes by, the lady runs into financial difficulties and has trouble buying food. She goes out onto her porch and asks God for help with groceries and then says, "Praise the Lord." The next morning, when she goes out onto the porch, there are the groceries she asked for. Of course, she shouts, "Praise the Lord." The atheist jumps out from behind a bush and says, "Ha, I bought those groceries. There is no God." The lady looks at him and smiles. She shouts, "Praise the Lord. Not only did you provide for me, Lord, but you made Satan pay for the groceries." Man, Sam Harris in his 2005 best-selling book, The End of Faith, provides what could be a stand-up routine based on his observations of religious faith. Tell a devout Christian his wife is cheating on him or that frozen yogurt can make a man invisible, and he is likely to require as much evidence as anyone else, and then be persuaded only to the extent that you give it. Tell him that the book he keeps by his bed was written by an invisible deity who will punish him with fire for eternity if he fails to accept every incredible claim, and he seems to require no evidence whatsoever. Harris fails to mention the downside of being an atheist. You have nobody to cry out to in the throes of an orgasm. Oh, heretical fellow. The 17th century French mathematician and philosopher Blaise Pascal argued that deciding whether or not to believe in God is essentially waging in a wager. If we choose to behave as if there is a God, and we get to the end and it turns out there isn't, it's not such a big deal. Well, maybe we've lost the ability to thoroughly enjoy the seven deadly sins, but that's small potatoes compared to the alternative. If we bet there isn't a God and get to the end only to find out that there is God, we lost the big enchilada, eternal bliss. Therefore, according to Pascal, it is a better strategy to live as if there is a God. This is known to academics as Pascal's wager. To the rest of us, it is known as simply hedging your bets. Inspired by Pascal's pensées, a little old lady goes to the bank with a satchel filled with $100,000 in cash and asks to open an account. The cautious banker asks where she got the money. "Gambling," she says. "I'm very good at gambling." Intrigued, the banker says, "What sort of bets do you make?" "Oh, all sorts," she says. "For example, I'll bet you $25,000 right now that by noon tomorrow you will have a butterfly tattoo on your right buttock." "Well, I would love to take that bet," the banker says, "but it wouldn't be right for me to take your money for such an absurd wager." "Let me put it to you this way," says the lady. "If you don't bet me, I'll have to find another bank for my money." Now, don't be hasty," says the banker. "I'll take your bet." The woman returns the next day at noon with her lawyer as a witness. The banker turns around, drops his pants, and invites the two to observe what he has, that he has won the bet. "Okay," says the woman, "but could you bend over just a little to make sure?" The banker obliges, and the woman concedes, counting out $25,000 in cash from her satchel. The lawyer, meanwhile, is sitting with his head in his hands. "What is wrong with him?" says the banker. "Ah, he's just a sore loser. I bet him $100,000, but by noon today, you'd moon us in your office." There's a fine line between hedging a bet and rigging the odds. Now, this is the way to learn philosophy of religion, brethren. A man with a parrot on his shoulder attends services on the first day of Rosh Hashanah. He had bet several people that the parrot can lead the service more beautifully than the cantor. When the time comes, though, the parrot is totally silent. At home afterward, the man berates the parrot and bemoans his losses. The parrot says, "Use your head, schmuck. Think of the odds. Think of the odds we can now get now on Yom Kippur. Ha ha. Hey, maybe the parrot is on to something. Maybe we can rig the odds of Pascal's wager so that we can play golf on Sunday morning and still keep God happy if he happens to exist. God knows we've all tried." Now, this is something that if you're plunging into the history of Freemasonry and Masonic thought, you'll hear about deism. 18th century philosophers, if they weren't skeptics, tended to be deists. Believers in a remote, impersonal God of the philosophers, a creator more like a force than a person, more like a clockmaker than a confidant. Traditional Jews and Christians pushed back. Their God, they said, was no mere clockmaker. He was the Lord of history, present in the Exodus from Egypt, the wandering in the desert and the settling of the promised land. He was, in a word, available, a very present help in trouble. A Jewish grandmother is watching her grandchild playing on the beach when a huge wave comes and takes him out to sea. She pleads, "Please, God, save my only grandson. I beg you, bring him back." And the big wave comes and washes the boy back onto the beach, good as new. She looks up to heaven and said, "He had a hat." Try saying that to a clockmaker. Now, there are theological distinctions. While philosophers of religion are worrying about big questions like, is there a God, theologians have smaller fish to fry, usually around Lent. Ha, ha, ha. According to 20th century philosopher and theologian Paul Tillich, there is more to the difference between the philosophy of religion and philosophy than the size of the fish. The philosopher, he says, pursues truth about God and God stuff as objectively as possible, while the theologian is already grasped by faith and engaged and committed. In other words, the philosopher of religion looks at God and religion from the outside, while the theologian looks at them from the inside. In theology, schisms have opened over such pressing issues as, does the Spirit proceed from the Father or from the Father and the Son? The layperson clearly needs a simple guide to theological differences, and thank God the comedians are always willing to oblige. The key to determining the religious persuasion of a person, it turns out, is whom he does or does not recognize. Jews don't recognize Jesus. Protestants don't recognize the Pope. Baptists don't recognize each other in the liquor store. I know. This last point translates into some very practical advice. If you're going fishing, don't invite a Baptist. He'll drink all the beer. However, if you invite two Baptists, you'll have it all to yourself. I get it. Have we remembered to be able to laugh at ourselves? If you lost that ability, you'll take me to the stockades this afternoon. Another way to differentiate denominations is according to what behavior qualifies somebody for a divine dressing down. For Catholics, it's missing Mass. For Baptists, it's dancing. For Episcopalians, it's eating your salad with your dessert fork. But seriously, there are important doctrinal differences amongst the denominations. For example, Catholics alone believe in the Immaculate Conception, the doctrine that in order to be able to carry the Lord, Mary herself was born without the taint of original sin. Jesus was walking through the street when he noticed a crowd throwing stones at an adulteress. And Jesus said, "Let whoever is without sin cast the first stone." Suddenly, a rock flew through the air. Smack! And Jesus turned and said, "Mom?" I get it. Everyone's favorite subgenre of sectarianism jokes, of course, is the Counter-Reformation joke. This is a real knee slapper. Get a grip on your wheel if you're driving and you're listening. Your basic collection of great Counter-Reformation jokes always contains this one. A man is in desperate financial straits and prays to God to save him by letting him win the lottery. Days go by, and then weeks, and the man fails to win a single lottery. And finally, in misery, he cries out to God, "You tell us, knock, and it shall be opened to you. Seek, and you shall find. I'm going down the tubes here, and I still haven't won the lottery." A voice from above answers, "You've got to meet me halfway, Bubla. Buy a ticket." This man was clearly a Protestant who, like Martin Luther, thought that we are saved by grace alone. There is nothing we can do to earn salvation. God, on the other hand, despite his apt use of the words bubla, is here carrying water for the Catholic Counter-Reformation. In fact, this joke may well have originated at the Council of Trent in 1545, where the bishops decided that salvation comes via a combination of grace and works, prayer, and buying a ticket. One belief that all the denominations have in common is that only their theology is the fast track to the divine. Amazing, isn't it? A man arrives at the gates of heaven, and St. Peter asks, "Religion?" The man says, "Methodist." St. Peter looks down his list to go to room 28, but be very quiet when you pass room 8. Another man arrives at the gates of heaven. "Religion?" "Baptist." "Go to room 18, but be very quiet as you pass room 8. A third man arrives at the gates. "Religion?" "Jewish." "Go to room 11, but be very quiet as you pass room 8. The man says, "I can understand there being different rooms for different religions, but why must I be quiet when I pass room 8? "Ah," St. Peter says, "that's the Jehovah's Witnesses are in room 8, and they think they're the only ones here." Now, I think that's a beautiful accommodation. It has been said that the 19th century German philosopher Arthur Schopenhauer discovered Buddhism philosophically. Like Gautama, the Buddha, 2 millennia earlier, Schopenhauer thought that all life is suffering, struggle, and frustration, and the only escape is resignation, the rejection of desire and denial of the will to live. On the upside, they both thought that resignation would lead to compassion for all things and saintliness, like it's a trade-off. A number of Jewish jokes poke fun at the ultimate Schopenhauer-esque pessimism. The Gewetter, Griper, two women are sitting on a bench. After a while, the first woman says, "Oi." The second woman says, "Oi." The first woman says, "All right, enough about the children." So you have a little bit of a sense of this? Once upon a time, there was a prince who, through no fault of his own, was placed under a spell by an evil witch. The curse was that the prince could speak only one word each year. He could, however, save up credits. So if he did not speak at all in one year, he could speak two words the following year. One day he met a beautiful princess and fell madly in love. He decided to refrain from speaking for 2 years so that he could look at her and say, "My darling." At the end of the 2 years, however, he wanted to also tell her that he loved her. So he decided to wait 3 more years, for a total of 5 years in silence. At the end of the 5 years, though, he knew he had to ask her to marry him, so he needed to wait another 4 years. Finally, as his 9th year of silence ended, he was understandably overjoyed. He led the princess to the most romantic part of the royal garden and knelt before her and said, "My darling, I love you. Will you marry me?" And the princess replied, "Pardon?" I know. 9 years. One word. Should he know better? Yeah, who am I? It was Lord Byron that said, "Adversity is the first path to truth." I hope the prince kept that in mind. A little adversity, suck it up here. He also said, "A woman should never be seen eating or drinking unless it be lobster salad and champagne, the only true feminine and becoming viands." You gotta love that guy. All who joy would win must share it. Happiness was born a twin. So, death so called is a thing which makes men weep, and yet a third of life is passed in sleep. Yes, love indeed is light from heaven, a spark of that immortal fire with angels shared by Allah, given to lift from earth our low desire. So remember, adversity is the first path to truth. As you go about your business, committing random acts of Masonic kindness, I hope. And I hope that you've enjoyed the program today. Come back next week. What have we got? We have next week a show. What do we have next week? Coming up, we have a guest coming. And I think we're looking at Optimism Hidden and a special guest on Things Masonic. Yes. My goodness. It should be interesting. So let me extend to you the hospitality of Masonic Home Companion. I look forward to seeing you again soon. It might start like something like this. I'll be back to finish the thought about some research. When I was initiated into the craft, it was a singular opportunity to live a right life. So I had to do a show about it because I thought maybe we all have something in common about that. Meanwhile, enjoy yourself. Enjoy yourself. May the great architect of the universe watch over you. Thank you.